Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. From the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, I have an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, Building Supply Company Buys Hartford Industrial Building. The owners of a sheetrock supply company have purchased a Hartford industrial building for more than $1 million. New York-based MacLad Corporation bought the 22,788-square-foot building located at 235 Newfield Avenue for $1.6 million from the owners of the Supply New England Plumbing Supply Company based out of Attleboro, Massachusetts. The MacLad Company dates back to 1986 and has one location in Long Island, New York, and one location on Bloomfield Avenue in Windsor. MacLad delivers drywall and building supplies as far north as Vermont and south to New Jersey, as well as all of Connecticut and Long Island. Supply New England occupied its only Connecticut location at this Hartford site for nearly 30 years before closing at the end of 2022, but the company remains operational in other states, according to broker Art Ross of Newmark Real Estate Services, who represented the seller in the April 19th deal. Small to mid-size freestanding industrial spaces like the Newfield Avenue property are in high demand, Ross said, and sold for asking price. The buyers were represented by Evan Berman of the Broader Commercial in West Hartford, or Broder Commercial. Berman said the new owners will make some minor modifications before moving into the building. The Hartford property is close to Bradley International Airport and major interstates including I-84, I-91, and I-291. Corporate neighbors include Triumph, Colt, LeGrand, DHL, Home Depot, Walmart, Aldi's, and BJ's. The property also has 28,000 square feet of potential outdoor storage or parking areas. Next, an article written by David Krzyzewski is titled, Fuel Cell Energy Announces $13 Million in Debt Financing for Derby Projects. Fuel Cell Energy Incorporated said on Monday it had closed on a project debt financing transaction with Liberty Bank and Connecticut Green Bank for its two fuel cell projects in Derby. The Danbury-based fuel cell company said Liberty Bank's senior commitment totals $6.5 million and Connecticut Green Bank's is $3 million. The Green Bank will contribute an additional subordinated credit facility of $3.5 million, bringing the total gross financing to $13 million. The net funding to the company totaled approximately $11.6 million after transaction fees and debt service reserves. The transaction closed on April 25th. The senior facility has a term of 7 years, while the subordinated credit facility's term is 14 years. The interest rate is fixed at 7.25% for the senior debt and at 8% for the subordinated debt. The two Derby projects include a 14-megawatt fuel cell park, the second largest fuel cell park in the United States. The Derby projects produce Class I, or 1, I guess, renewable energy as part of 20-year power purchase agreements with Eversource and United Illuminating. The second project supported by this financing is a 2.8-megawatt fuel cell project also located in Derby. In Connecticut, a Class I or 1 renewable energy source includes electricity produced from solar, wind, or geothermal power or fuel cells. The fuel cell modules of both facilities were made at Fuel Cell Energy's factory in Torrington, the company said. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Skylar Fraser is titled, House Passes Bill Modifying Housing Tax Credit Eligibility. The State House of Representatives has passed a bill that modifies eligibility requirements for an apartment tax credit program by increasing the percentage of units that must be designated as workforce housing. House Bill 5153, which was introduced by the Housing Committee, makes changes to a tax credit program created last year for workforce housing development projects through the Connecticut Housing Finance Authority, or CHFA, and State Department of Housing, or DOH, The bill modifies the specifications of new projects eligible through CHFA's Housing Tax Credit Contribution Program, which provides tax credit vouchers for businesses that make cash contributions to nonprofits that develop, sponsor, or manage affordable housing developments. The tax credits can apply against various business taxes. Specifically, the bill increases the percentage of units that must be rented to the workforce population, such as teachers, police officers, firefighters, or other eligible groups, from 40 to 50%. It also decreases the share of units that must be rented at market rate from 50 to 40%. The remaining 10% of units must be reserved for affordable housing. That remains unchanged. So who's for this bill? The Connecticut Business and Industry Association supported the bill, saying it would help the new tax credits established in last year's law operate effectively. Our state is in a workforce shortage with over 90,000 jobs currently open. To help fill those jobs, we need to ensure that there are affordable housing options available to our workforce, said CBIA lobbyist Peter Myers, adding, this program will help to create more affordable housing options for our workforce. And who's against it? No one testified in opposition to the bill when it was in committee, but advocacy group Connecticut Voices for Children asked for the percentage of units reserved for affordable housing to be increased from 10%. And what's next? The State House of Representatives passed the bill in a 147-0 vote on April 25th, so the proposal now goes to the Senate for consideration. If it passes both chambers, the bill will go to Governor Ned Lamont, who can sign it into law, veto it, or do nothing. Next, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled Berkshire Bank Shrinking Connecticut Presence with Pending Branch Closures. Boston-based Berkshire Bank, which first entered the Connecticut market following its 2012 acquisition of the Connecticut Bank and Trust Company in Hartford, has notified the State Department of Banking that it plans to close three branches in the Nutmeg State. Berkshire Bank, a subsidiary of the publicly traded Berkshire Hills Bancorp, is asking the banking department permission to close the branches with a combined $113.6 million in deposits by June 28. The branches slated for closure are located at 596 Hartford Pike in Dayville. It has $62 million in deposits as of June 30, 2023. Next, 114 Woodland Street in Hartford at St. Francis Hospital with $3.2 million in deposits, and 159 Merrill Road in Tolland with $48.4 million in deposits. The pending closures come following the departure earlier this year of one of Berkshire's top bankers in Connecticut, Jeffrey Klaus, who was hired by the bank in 2021 to serve as senior vice president and regional president and middle market team leader in Southern Connecticut, based in New Haven. Klaus was recruited to lead the bank's expansion in New Haven and the rest of Southern Connecticut. He left the bank in January, according to his LinkedIn page. Meantime, in 2022, Berkshire Bank sold its 20,000-square-foot operations center in Windom for $1 million as part of a broader effort to rethink its post-pandemic office space needs, the bank said at the time. In a statement about the pending branch closures, a Berkshire Bank spokesperson said the bank is committed to delivering an exceptional customer experience. We regularly evaluate our network of financial centers to ensure we are delivering our services based on customer preferences. Berkshire Bank remains committed to serving our clients and communities in Connecticut through our network of nearly 20 financial center locations in the state. Berkshire Bank established its brick-and-mortar presence in the state following its 2012 purchase of the tiny Hartford-based Connecticut Bank and Trust Company, which at the time of the deal had $280 million in assets and 8 branches serving the greater Hartford area. Berkshire followed up that deal with its 2019 acquisition of Willimantic-based SI Financial Group, parent of the Savings Institute and Trust Company. That $180 million purchase grew Berkshire's Connecticut presence from 9 to 27 branches and an additional $1.7 billion in assets. As of June 30, 2023, Berkshire reported 21 branches in Connecticut with $1.5 billion in assets. The bank announced in December 2020 a plan to trim its brick-and-mortar branch network by about 18% in the first half of 2021. Besides Connecticut and Massachusetts, Berkshire Bank, with $12.1 billion in overall assets, has a presence in Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, and Vermont. And as you can hear, I think the mailman is here. The bank's parent company reported a $20.2 million loss during the first quarter of 2024, down from $27.6 million profit in the year-ago period. In March, the bank announced plans to sell 10 of its branches in upstate and eastern New York. The bank attributed its first quarter loss in part to the sale of $362 million in securities, which resulted in a $49.9 million non-operating charge. Next up, an article written by Skylar Fraser, titled, Senate Approves a Bill That Would Make It Easier to Convert Commercial Buildings to Apartments. The state Senate on Wednesday approved a bill that would make it easier for a developer or landlord to repurpose commercial buildings into residential properties, a proposal supporters say will help increase housing production in Connecticut, while detractors argue it will take away local control over zoning. Senate Bill 416 is one of the first bills that would mandate changes to the way municipalities regulate land use to pass through either chamber this session, according to the Connecticut Mirror. The bill passed Wednesday evening largely along party lines, with two Democrats not voting. Lawmakers debated the bill for about 6 hours, the Mirror reported. The bill allows the conversion or partial conversion of any commercial building into a residential development as of right, meaning that a municipality must approve such a proposal if it complies with normal zoning regulations. As of right means a town or city cannot require a public hearing, special permit, or any other discretionary zoning action other than considering normal zoning regulations. However, converted buildings still are not exempt from any applicable building, fire safety, or fire prevention codes. So what's at stake? Partially due to the COVID-19 pandemic and a general shifting of workplace conditions across the country, many commercial properties in Connecticut sit vacant or underutilized as more employers allow for hybrid and remote work, reducing the need for office space. With housing supply a constant concern in the state, converting these properties to residential developments has been seen as an increasingly popular option. However, many new housing projects in Connecticut, especially ones located in the suburbs and near single-family communities, have received pushback from nearby neighbors. Planning and zoning commissions have blocked some developments in the face of that opposition. State lawmakers have considered a number of proposals this year to encourage new apartment development, including one that would provide incentives for office-to-apartment conversions. Senate Bill 416 does not offer any type of financial incentives for such conversions. Who's for it? Well, the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Connecticut CEO Jim Paris testified earlier this year that the trade group believes the bill is a progressive step towards addressing Connecticut's housing shortage. By removing unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles, this legislation empowers property owners to repurpose commercial spaces efficiently, meeting the growing demand for residential units, Paris said. Crucially, the prohibition on municipalities conditioning approval based on non-conforming elements eliminates a major barrier to conversion projects. This creates a favorable environment for property owners, encouraging them to invest in repurposing underutilized commercial buildings without the burden of addressing unrelated issues, he added. Who's against it? Connecticut Conference of Municipalities Advocacy Manager Zachary McCowan said that zoning and permitting processes should be left up to towns and cities. There are very different types of commercial buildings that may not be suitable, conversion, or appropriate within the area, he said. For example, a mall is a far different development than a small corner office building. The bill does not take into account a variety of factors, including surrounding areas, consideration of housing type, density, or even the possibility of conversion, to name a few. Following the Senate's approval, the bill now goes to the State House of Representatives for consideration. We are listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with more after this break.
The American School for the Deaf provides their students with an array of options during the summer months to prevent academic regression and continue the momentum of learning from the school year. One such option is their extended school year, a half-day education program for students referred through their individualized education plan. It is open to both ASD and non-ASD students and incorporates thematic learning experiences and work opportunities for older students as part of their transition programming. Also offered during the summer is their overnight camp, Camp Isola Bella. The camp is located in Salisbury, Connecticut, is designed for deaf and hard of hearing students as well as children of deaf adults and children with deaf siblings. Campers engage in sports and recreation activities, building relationship skills and self-esteem in a nourishing and fun environment. The camp is open to children ages 8 through 17, with 3 sessions each summer. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf, always able.
Welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Keith Fanoff. It's titled, Report Shows Billions More in Taxes Coming into Connecticut Than Expected. As legislators learned Tuesday, state budget surpluses would top or approach $1 billion through 2026. Leaders said Connecticut must scale back an aggressive savings program that critics say is choking core programs. The program that forces legislators to save a portion of volatile income and business tax receipts will capture $1.12 billion this fiscal year, $645 million more than originally anticipated, according to a joint report from Governor Ned Lamont's Budget Office staff and the legislature's Nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis. Originally expected to capture slightly more than $450 million in cash in each of the next 2 fiscal years, the volatility adjustment now is projected to collect almost $1.2 billion in 2024-25 and $910 million in 2025-26. And none of those projections includes increases in federal Medicaid grants and miscellaneous revenues that will boost this fiscal year's operating surplus from $86 million to $257 million. This might be the most shocking consensus revenue numbers we've seen in years, House Speaker Matt Ritter, Democrat from Hartford, said during a mid-morning press conference, adding, folks, the state is in a very solid financial position. But the Speaker and Senate President Pro Tem Martin M. Looney, a Democrat from New Haven, who commented during separate interviews, also said Connecticut needs to adjust the black ink it's piling up, because while it bolsters budget reserves and reduces pension debt, legislators are scrambling to find a fraction of this revenue boon, about $400 million, to avert further cuts next fiscal year in higher education and human services. I think we absolutely need to reassess the volatility threshold, Looney said, adding no one envisioned the state would be forced to save $1 billion or more annually when this system first was approved in October 2017. With the latest projections, the overall state budget surplus this fiscal year is projected to exceed $1 billion for the fifth time in 6 years, according to records from the state comptroller's office. And the numbers say two more $1 billion surpluses are achievable by 2026. This volatility program, along with new caps on spending and borrowing and other budget controls, helped end a string of deficits and control the roller coaster effect that volatile revenues can have on state finances, Looney said. The state's considerable pension debt also is considerable, totaling more than $37 billion entering this year, according to Lamont's budget office. But given the huge savings it's forced every year, I think it's quite possible we may be defining certain revenue as volatile that should be considered predictable, Looney added. Majority Democrats in the House and Senate increasingly have joined other critics of this system over the past year, arguing the savings program is poorly designed. They said it inaccurately classifies millions of dollars of stable revenue as volatile to the detriment of education and human services. Legislators have been scrambling to find extra funds to bolster these core programs next fiscal year. Because these volatile revenues cannot be touched, they've been stripping emergency federal pandemic aid from other programs and redirecting it to public colleges and universities, as well as social services for people with disabilities. No one in the legislature has proposed repealing this saving system, but many have said it should be adjusted to allow more funds to be spent. Ritter didn't propose any specific changes on Tuesday to the system that currently prevents legislators from spending more than $3.78 billion of the annual receipts from quarterly income tax filings, which chiefly reflect capital gains, dividends, and other investment earnings by wealthy households, and quarterly filings by certain partnerships and other businesses that pay the pass-through entity tax. But the Speaker said he expects the legislators will be ready to review and revisit a threshold next year that has not been re-evaluated since 2018. House Minority Leader Vincent Candeloria, a Republican from North Brantford, has said on several occasions that Democratic legislators and the governor should be focusing more on finding ways to curb spending in the next budget rather than seeking for ways to work around the guardrails, such as spending emergency federal pandemic aid, which can be spent outside of the budget. I know the governor and the Democrats are trying to negotiate their way out of this and pretend that they're honoring these guardrails, but I am very concerned that they are setting up for next year these guardrails to fail, he said. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson. It's titled, Connecticut-based Subway completes a $9.6 billion sale to private equity firm. Fast food sandwich chain Subway, based in Shelton and Miami, has completed its sale to Rourke Capital, an Atlanta-based private equity firm that owns other prominent fast food franchises. The deal was originally announced in August. A purchase price wasn't disclosed, but the Wall Street Journal reported previously that Rourke's offer was about $9.6 billion. That would make the deal the second largest U.S. acquisition of a U.S. restaurant chain since at least 1995, according to the Wall Street Journal, which cited data provider Dealogic. Subway has deep Connecticut roots and was founded by Fred DeLuca and Peter Buck in Bridgeport in 1965. For decades, the company remained closely held. The acquisition was completed on Tuesday, according to an announcement. The announcement says Subway has had 3 years of sales growth and positive global net restaurant growth for the first time since 2016. The company recently unveiled new menu items, including wraps and sandwich sidekicks. The entire Subway system is excited that our sale to Rourke is complete, said John Chidsey, CEO of Subway, adding, as we look to our future, our growth journey is far from over. With a continued strategic focus on delivering better food and a better guest experience, our next chapter will be the most exciting yet. Subway is the eighth largest U.S. restaurant chain and has nearly 37,000 restaurants globally. In October, Subway opened a new 90,000-square-foot global dual headquarters in Shelton, which featured an upgraded and modernized workspace. Rourke, which has $38 billion in equity under management, describes the food and restaurant industry as its largest sector, with investments in brands such as Dunkin', Buffalo Wild Wings, Carvel Ice Cream, and Cinnabon. Next up, an article written by Skylar Fraser titled, Bristol Manufacturer Secures $4.5 million investment and plans to add jobs. A Bristol-based design and manufacturing company has secured a $4.5 million investment that it says will help grow the company and add up to 30 new jobs. Whitman Controls, which designs and manufactures pressure, vacuum level, and temperature switches, received the investment from New Orleans-based Advantage Capital in conjunction with InvestCT, a state incentive program that offers funding to entrepreneurs who have had issues securing traditional forms of capital to grow their businesses. Whitman Controls, which is owned by Washington, D.C.-based private equity firm LDR Growth Partners, said it plans to use the funds to purchase new equipment to expand its manufacturing capabilities and distribution channels. The company also plans to use the money for certain acquisition opportunities in the industrial sensors segment. In all, the company expects the new funding to bring up to 30 new jobs to the area through different avenues of investment. According to data from the State Department of Economic and Community Development, the InvestCT program has created more than 1,500 jobs since 2016. The program specifically targets small businesses such as Whitman Controls or pre-seed and early-stage companies looking for financial assistance. Advantage Capital is an investment firm that targets underserved markets. Since 1992, the company said it has invested over $4.1 billion in over 900 companies. Next, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson is titled, Six Connecticut Manufacturers Receive $100,000 State Matching Grants for Technology Upgrades. Six Connecticut-based manufacturers with less than 300 employees will receive $100,000 state grants to adopt new technologies, Governor Ned Lamont announced on Wednesday. The additive technologies will improve operations and drive innovation, such as high-end 3D metal printers for functional parts and tooling, and advanced plastic printing capabilities, the announcement says. The companies will each provide a matching grant of an equal or greater amount. The recipients are Advanced Manufacturing LLC in Windsor, Arex Rubber Products Corporation in Portland, Integrated Illumination Systems Incorporated in Morris, Mott Corporation in Farmington, TriMec Solutions LLC in Deep River, and Westcon Tool and Die Incorporated in Shelton. The competitive grants are from the Additive Manufacturing Adoption Program, part of the state's Manufacturing Innovation Fund, which is administered by the State Department of Economic and Community Development. Lamont said that manufacturing remains a high-growth sector nationwide. We want to do everything we can to ensure that Connecticut is at the forefront of the jobs and economic growth that it is delivering, Lamont said, adding this grant program is a way we can partner with small manufacturers in our state to support their growth. New Britain-based AVNA, formerly OK Industries, which produces medical devices, received a 2021 grant through the program. The company says it used the money to lower lead times for in-house tooling and prototyping processes. We'll now turn to the Thursday, May 2nd New York Times business section, starting off with our business news roundup. First article, what will it take for the Fed to lower rates? The wait continues. Global markets are still processing the probability that the United States interest rates will remain higher for longer as the Fed acknowledges that high inflation has forced it into a holding pattern on interest rates. That's putting new emphasis on Friday's jobs report as Wall Street and policymakers look for clues on how the labor market is affecting inflation and the wider economy. U.S. futures are pointing to a modest rise after stocks in some parts of Asia and Europe sank. That came after a topsy-turvy final hour of trading on Wednesday in New York. The S&P 500 surged when Jay Powell, the Fed chair, said during his news conference that an interest rate increase was unlikely, only to plunge when he backed away from offering clear guidance on when the cuts may be coming. The Fed needs greater confidence that inflation is heading down, Powell said, citing the central bank's long outstanding target of 2%. That level remains the subject of persistent debate. But if anything, price data has shown inflation rising since the start of the year. At the same time, consumer sentiment has fallen, with bellwether companies including Starbucks and McDonald's reporting disappointing first quarter sales. Everybody's fighting for fewer consumers or consumers that are certainly visiting less frequently, Ian Borden, McDonald's CFO, told analysts on Tuesday. A few other takeaways from Powell's comments. He thinks that inflation will creep down over the course of this year, but that's still not enough conviction for the Fed to be more specific about its outlook on cuts. And the futures market on Thursday was penciling in 0.35 percentage points worth of cuts this year to the Fed's prime lending rate, compared with predictions in January that the central bank would lower by more than 1.5 percentage points. And Powell does not see a risk of stagflation. The economy is growing at roughly 3%, and the inflation rate is under 3% over the past year, he said, adding, I don't see the stag or the flation. Friday's non-farm payrolls report is in the spotlight. Economists forecast that employers added 233,000 jobs last month, keeping the unemployment rate steady at 3.8%. That's despite some headline-grabbing layoffs in recent weeks at Alphabet, Tesla, and Apple. A wild card is wage data. A strong number there could indicate persistent inflationary pressures, making the Fed more reluctant to lower borrowing costs. Another data point, the OECD on Thursday said global inflation was likely to ease this year, but warned that tensions in the Middle East could jolt the oil market and dash that best-case scenario. There are signs of a cool down in the jobs market. Labor Department data released on Wednesday showed that the pace of hiring had begun to abate, with the number of unfilled job openings falling to a roughly three-year low. Four short articles in what's happening in the business world. First up, ExxonMobil strikes an agreement to win regulatory approval of its $60 billion mega deal. The oil giant will agree not to add Scott Sheffield, the former CEO of Pioneer Natural Resources, as a director in exchange for the FTC clearing the transaction, according to the Wall Street Journal. Elsewhere, shares in Shell were up after the producer reported $7.7 billion in adjusted quarterly earnings, beating analyst expectations. And the price of gas keeps climbing. The U.S. imposes sanctions on Chinese companies over military support for Russia's war effort. The Biden administration announced on Wednesday nearly 300 sanctions, including on more than a dozen Chinese businesses, aimed at disrupting Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Both Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Secretary of State Antony Blinken had warned Chinese officials during their recent trips there about what they say is Beijing's continued support of Russia's war. Next, Novo Nordisk feels the heat from competition in weight loss drugs. Shares in the Danish drug maker were down on Thursday, despite the company more than doubling sales of its blockbuster Wegovy treatment and raising revenue forecast. The culprit? Pressure on prices amid growing competition from Eli Lilly's Zepbound, supply constraints, and scrutiny from lawmakers. In our last short article, a top U.S. lawmaker investigates the FTC's work with the EU on a failed Amazon deal. Representative James Comer, a Republican of Kentucky, and the chairman of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee demanded the agency's correspondence with the European Commission related to Amazon's aborted $1.4 billion takeover of iRobot. While global competition agencies regularly communicate about their scrutiny of deals, Comer wants to know whether the American agency coordinated with its counterpart to effectively block the deal. Next article in the Business Roundup, Big Tech's Competition Test. Google and the Justice Department will face off again in court on Thursday for closing arguments in the first tech monopoly trial of the modern internet age. The government's lawsuit is centered on Google's dominance of the search market. Yet many experts think the case will test regulators' ability to rein in big tech at a time when artificial intelligence and other innovations are poised to reshape technology. The case hinges on how Google throws its weight around. Its core search engine conducts nearly 90% of web searches, which the company chalks up to its technical superiority. But it also pays companies tens of billions of dollars to make its search engine the default on browsers like Apple's Safari and Mozilla's Firefox. Prosecutors say those arrangements defend its monopoly and blunt competition in search ads. A big unknown is potential remedies if the presiding judge rules against Google. The Justice Department has not said which fixes it would seek, but Biden administration officials have suggested that they would address the issue of Google's scale in search. Among the possibilities, a ban on deals that set a default service on devices, though that doesn't address Google's control of search data. Another, according to Matt Stoller, the research director of the American Economic Liberties Project, a progressive think tank, is making Google create a way to give rivals access to its data. One that's most likely not on the table, according to some experts, a breakup. The bigger issue, critics worry about other markets Google might dominate. Since the Justice Department sued the company in 2020, other technologies, notably generative artificial intelligence tools, have risen to prominence. Google's rivals, which have worried about the company's AI prowess, said they feared that the tech giant might use its search market tactics to win the AI race as well. Despite my enthusiasm that there is a new angle with AI, I worry a lot that this vicious cycle that I'm trapped in could get even more vicious, Satya Nadella, Microsoft CEO, testified last year. Next article in the roundup, will the third time be a charm for J&J? Johnson & Johnson is making another attempt at using a contentious legal technique to end a decade-long battle over claims that its talcum powder products caused cancer. The proposed $6.5 billion settlement is one of the biggest tests yet of the so-called Texas two-step process, which allows companies to split off liabilities into a separate unit that files for bankruptcy. If Johnson & Johnson's latest bid works, more companies could use that tactic. So here's how the Texas two-step works. A company creates a subsidiary to take on liability for a wave of lawsuits. The new entity immediately seeks Chapter 11 protection, turning the plaintiffs into creditors. The process allows the overall company to stay out of bankruptcy and insulates it from legal battles. Courts rejected Johnson & Johnson's previous attempts. Judges ruled that bankruptcy wasn't the right way to address the settlements because the subsidiary could not show it was under financial distress. Johnson & Johnson, which has already spent $178 million in legal fees on those efforts and has long denied the accusations, has said it would appeal the latest ruling to the Supreme Court. This round has a new twist. The company plans to file a prepackaged bankruptcy if 75% of claimants vote to accept the settlement. In effect, all the bankruptcy court is doing is stamping yes on an agreement that has already been reached, Jared Elias, a Harvard Law School professor who specializes in corporate bankruptcy law, told the Deal Book. It's not yet clear whether the plan would withstand legal challenges. Critics say that the approach abuses the bankruptcy system by allowing financially solvent companies to use it to avoid responsibility, while proponents argue it effectively resolves a flood of lawsuits at once. In January, a group of U.S. senators and state attorneys general urged the Supreme Court to curb the use of the tactic. Companies will be watching closely. To the extent this is successful, it's going to be a new tool in the corporate toolkit, Elias said. And our final article in the New York Times Business Roundup, TikTok gets some good news. Universal Music Group on Thursday announced a new licensing deal with TikTok, ending the label's months-long boycott of the platform. It's welcome news for TikTok as the short video app battles to avoid being banned in the United States. Universal told TikTok to remove its music from the platform in February, accusing the company of underpaying and failing to stem a flood of AI-generated recordings on its platform that reduced the amount of money available for human musicians. TikTok shot back that Universal was being greedy and cutting off its artists' access to a key promotional platform. The fight took a turn when Taylor Swift, who is a Universal artist, reappeared on TikTok to promote her latest album last month. Details of the deal were not released. Universal said it had secured more money and better protection against AI, while TikTok said it would do more to promote Universal's artists. Both companies added that they would cooperate on new ways to make money using TikTok's growing e-commerce features. Both sides can claim a win. Universal can show investors that it's an industry leader in dealing with big tech, Mark Mulligan, an analyst at Media Research, told DealBook. Shares in the label were up this morning. He added that the resolution underscored the importance of TikTok's soft power in building fan bases for artists. But Mulligan said that ByteDance, the Chinese owner of TikTok, has not actually signaled any pullback from AI. Unlike Spotify, TikTok is not a music platform. It is a platform with music as its soundtrack, he said. It is far easier for TikTok to substitute human music for AI music, which is what scares music rights holders, he added. One more thought. Given the uncertainty of TikTok's future in the United States, the companies may have been smart to do a deal that benefits both of them, at least in the short term. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
Located in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, Oak Hills Camp Harkness is hiring for the summer. Our fully accessible camp is designed to meet the interests and needs of children and adults along the disability spectrum by providing activities that are creative, adventurous, and fun. We are looking for counselors, lifeguards, and team leaders, just to name a few. This opportunity is perfect for recent high school graduates or college students looking to make a difference this summer. Join Oak Hill for a summer you will always remember with individuals you will never forget. Oak Hill's Camp Harkness, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
And welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. Next up from the New York Times business section, an article written by Amanda Holpuck. It's titled, Dave & Buster's to allow betting on arcade games. The restaurant and arcade chain Dave & Buster's is going to let customers bet on arcade games, according to an announcement on Tuesday. Customers will be able to digitally place cash bets at the arcades where people play games like skee-ball, billiards, and basketball shootouts. A technology company, Lucra, is teaming up with Dave & Buster's to provide the digital betting service. Michael Madding, Lucra's chief operating officer, said in an interview on Wednesday that the company's product would be used for skill-based games at Dave & Buster's, including recreational activities for which the outcome is largely or entirely dependent on the knowledge, ability, strength, speed, endurance, intelligence of the participants, and is subject to the control of those participants. Dave & Buster's did not respond to requests for comment, and it was not clear which specific games customers would be able to place bets on or when the company would roll out the betting product, which will be available to people enrolled in the Dave & Buster's loyalty program. Mr. Madding said that Lucra's products are available to people 18 and older, and that the company allows its partners and consumers to set limits based on their needs and preferences. Our typical average contest size for Lucra's technology is around $5 to $10, he said. On social media, people poked fun at the announcement, joking, for example, about whether customers might bet on such games as skee-ball. The age policies vary at each Dave & Buster's location, but generally people under 18 years old can enter without or with a guardian. Mark Edelman, a law professor and the director of sports ethics at Barrett College in New York said there is a carve-out in gambling laws that allows for people who are engaging in a physical competition to compete for money in that competition. For example, professional golfers and tennis players pay an entry fee to compete and can win a cash prize. If two people are competing against one another in skee ball, presuming that there is nothing unusual done in the skee ball game and physical skill is actually going to determine the winner, there's no problem, Professor Edelman said. The trouble lies in the people betting on others' games. If I'm taking a bet on whether someone else will win a skee ball game or whether someone else will achieve a particular score in skee ball, if I myself am not engaged in a physical competition, that very likely would be seen as gambling, Professor Edelman said. There are 164 Dave & Buster's locations in North America, and it was not clear how many would allow betting. Dr. Leah Noer, director of the Center for Gambling Studies at Rutgers University, said that she was concerned about children who go to Dave & Buster's being exposed to people placing bets, which she said could lead to a gambling addiction. The younger people begin doing these things, and the more types of things they do, the more likely down the road they are to experience problems. Dr. Noer said, adding, and so, by allowing more and more of this to take place, we're setting up our younger generation for problems that we have not put the safeguards in place to take care of. Next up, an article written by Chris Hamby. It's titled, Collusion in Healthcare Pricing? Regulators Are Asked to Investigate. Recent revelations about a data analytics firm's role in determining medical payments have heightened concerns about possible price fixing in healthcare and led to a call for a federal investigation. In a letter this week, Senator Amy Klobuchar asked federal regulators to examine whether algorithms used by the firm MultiPlan have helped major health insurers conspire to cut payments to doctors and leave patients with large bills. She cited a New York Times investigation last month into MultiPlan's dominance of the lucrative business of pricing out-of-network medical claims. Algorithms should be used to make decisions more accurate, appropriate, and efficient, not to allow competitors to collude to make healthcare more costly for patients, Ms. Klobuchar wrote to the heads of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission. When patients see a medical provider outside their plan's network, insurers often send their claims to MultiPlan, which uses proprietary algorithms to recommend how much to pay. By driving down payments to providers, MultiPlan and the insurers can collect higher fees for themselves, the Times reported, but this can lead to higher bills for patients who may get charged the unpaid balance. United Healthcare, Cigna, Aetna, and other major insurers use MultiPlan's pricing recommendations, and the firm has boasted to investors that it is deeply embedded in its clients' claims processing systems. In interviews, Ms. Klobuchar, a Democrat from Minnesota, and experts in antitrust law said this arrangement could amount to price fixing. Rather than competing to offer better coverage, insurers can use the low prices recommended by MultiPlan's algorithms, knowing their competitors would likely do the same. This should trigger an investigation by the agencies, said Barack Auerbach, a law professor at the University of Arizona, adding, there seems to be a really strong case. The FTC and Justice Department declined to comment, but both agencies have raised concerns in the past about similar arrangements in other industries. In a statement, MultiPlan did not address the price-fixing allegations, instead emphasizing its commitment to helping make healthcare transparent, fair, and affordable for all. In legal filings, the firm has denied allegations of collusion and said that insurers are free to reject its pricing recommendations or negotiate higher payments with providers. Insurers have said that MultiPlan's tools help combat outrageous billing by some providers, including consolidated hospital systems and private equity-backed staffing firms. Documents reviewed by The Times indicate that MultiPlan has sometimes told insurers how their unnamed competitors were using the firm's pricing tools. In a 2017 presentation to United Healthcare, MultiPlan shared recent client strategies to improve results, which included techniques that could reduce payments to providers. After a 2019 meeting, a United Healthcare senior vice president reported to her colleagues that a MultiPlan executive did not specifically name competitors, but from what he did say, we were able to glean who was who. She then described how Cigna, Aetna, and some Blue Cross Shield plans were apparently using the firm's pricing tools. Three hospital systems have sued MultiPlan, accusing it of colluding with major insurers to set unreasonably low payments for medical care, and patients and providers have complained to the FTC about MultiPlan, records obtained through a public records request show. One provider reported slashed payments from United Healthcare, Cigna, and an Aetna subsidiary after the insurers routed claims to MultiPlan's most aggressive pricing tool. Another said, "The tool has decimated my life and caused the closing of my business, which has left patients having to travel 2.5 hours for surgery." Patients complained to the agency of receiving large bills after insurers used MultiPlan recommended prices. "This is now affecting my credit score," wrote one patient, describing a bill that had been sent to a debt collector. Another reported being billed thousands of dollars since they refused to pay my providers the correct amount. Ms. Klobuchar has introduced legislation that would effectively make the agency's position the default. Courts would presume it illegal for competitors to share non-public data with a middleman and use the pricing recommendations that the firm's algorithms produced. It's not clear whether current antitrust laws are sufficient to stop this practice, Ms. Klobuchar said in an interview, adding, "It is much better just to clarify this and to close the loophole." The bill would also require companies to tell consumers if they are buying something that was priced using an algorithm, and it would give regulators greater authority to demand details about how an algorithm works. Well, I'll finish off the show with a few short articles from this week's Hartford Business Journal. First up, written by Hannah Snyder Gambini, an article titled "Large Portfolio of Downtown Middletown Properties Listed for Sale." A unique portfolio of mixed-use buildings prominently located along Middletown's Main Street has been listed for $6.75 million. The five-building package contains a combined 59 residential units and 8 commercial spaces in nearly 54,900 square feet of space. It's unique that a grouping of buildings along a key commercial stretch like Middletown's Main Street is under one ownership and sold as a package, said broker Taylor Perrin of Shelton-based Northeast Private Client Group, which has the listing. The properties were picked up piecemeal by owner Lee Perry over the last several years, Perrin said. Perry, a New York-based private real estate investor, set out to create an assemblage of buildings in a thriving downtown center, Perrin said. The commercial spaces are 100% leased with many long-term and established tenants, and most of the residential units are occupied, Perrin said. The properties include 542 Main Street with 4 one-bedroom apartments and 1 retail suite. 594 to 606 Main Street is 2 parcels with adjacent buildings containing a mix of studios, lofts, one, two, and three-bedroom units, along with three retail tenants, including Forest City Wine and Spirits, Smoke 911, and Ion Restaurant. 682 Main Street has 12 two-bedroom apartments and two retail suites, with tenants Crust Pizza Bar and Middletown Pharmacy, and 710 Main Street, which has six two-bedroom apartments and two retail suites. This is Perry's only Connecticut portfolio, and he's selling them to focus on the New York market, Perrin said. Middletown has a busy Main Street with many shops, restaurants, professional and community buildings, along with close proximity to the riverfront and Wesleyan University. The city has seen a lot of growth and outside investment, Perrin said. The portfolio has been on the market for about 2 weeks, and Perrin said he has just started showing the properties this week, and the interest so far has been significant. The type of investors that we are trying to capture that would have the capacity to pick these up are able to get a lot of units in one shot, Perrin said. Having established retail tenants and multiple units under one management team allows for more cash flow, he said. But you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.